Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Because
I think we're all searching. There are some people that think that the media would
bias. Bias.
It's Wednesday, September 21st, 2011, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. I'm Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Perched in their usual pundit chairs are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. Media coverage of two new books leads to claims of shoddy journalism. We'll debate the hype surrounding The Rogue, a brutal and sketchily sourced critique of Sarah Palin, and Confidence Men, an insider's look at President Obama and his economic team that has the White House crying foul. A lengthy and remarkable essay in The Atlantic this month has the media talking again about whether college athletes should be paid. The federal agency charged with watching the weather says too many Joplin residents were confused or complacent in face of warnings about the tornado that claimed 162 lives back in May. And we'll respond to a listener comment on our blog. First, let's tackle two books released just yesterday that are leading to lots of angst in political circles. Since it would have been nearly impossible for us to read them both in 24 hours, we'll have to rely for the moment on excerpts, interviews, pushback, and early commentary. We begin with author Ron Suskind's latest. It's called Confidence Men, Wall Street, Washington, and the Education of a President. Suskind's principal claim is that President Obama is a brilliant amateur who got rolled by his economic team in the first 2 years of his administration, but is doing better now at managing the White House. Last night, in a friendly interview with The Daily Show's Jon Stewart, Suskind reiterated his contention that Obama was seduced by intellectuals like Larry Summers, his chief economic advisor, until late last year.
You know, Obama loves these high IQ guys. Larry, of course, is the top of the heap there with sterling credentials. And he sort of ends up in what I call the Larry Summers Debate Society. Now, I think Obama felt he'd sit above it and sort of judge who's the winner. Right. He ends up kind of just another guy at the table in a lot of ways. Larry's saying, I'll go first, you go after me. It troubles people who are sitting there saying, wait a second, is that being disrespectful to the president? Eventually, you see the president's confidence sort of bruised. And frankly, that's why Confidence Men's the title.
Suskind notes that Timothy Geithner, who's still Obama's Treasury Secretary, even walked back, that's stalled in lay terms, the president's attempt to break up Citigroup at the height of the financial crisis. In a much more hostile interview on the Today Show this morning, Ann Curry spends most of her time rather breathlessly calling out Suskind on copy editing errors he made in the book.
We did some looking through your book, and you do call in your book, you make some mistakes. CNBC reporter Erin Burnett, right. Well, you called her Erin Burkett. You say the unemployment in June 2009 was 8%. In fact, it was 9.5%. You say that the Dow drops 378 on February 10, 2009. In fact, it dropped 382 points on that date. So do you agree? Jay Carney makes this point. Do you agree with him that if you cannot get these details right, then the broader analysis that you subscribe to, that you put forth in this book, has got to be judged in accordance with that, has got to be questioned. There are inaccuracies in your book.
This is a 500-page book. The fact of the matter is everything in this book is solid as a brick.
Suskind points out in this and other recordings that many of the things that he talked about at the White House were recorded. Many of those interviews are there to document the claims that he's done. And in fact, the Washington Post ran a story basically sustaining the thesis that we haven't gotten to yet in the book, which was that for a while, the White House was a boys' club that was really hostile to the women staff members. And we'll get to that claim in just a minute. But let's talk about the principal thesis first, Lee. And that's this notion that, here he is inside the White House. He's got access to the economic team. And a lot of folks in the first couple of years appear to be not paying attention to the president's directives or deciding they don't need to follow through as quickly as they should.
again, you're right, Mike. We all need to say we haven't read the book. And I thought that Stewart's interview began with actually one of the few dumb questions I've ever heard John Stewart ask, which was the assertion that we want presidents to be educated before they hit the Oval Office. Well, on one level, that's true. But our great presidents are presidents who have learned during their presidencies. That's kind of the test, really, of presidential leadership. Whether or not Susskind is going to come back in 2 years or 4 years, if Obama is reelected, and chronicle whether or not he has learned from, you know, whatever the takeoff place was. I think that's the book that, quite frankly, I'm more interested in reading. Having said that, I also have to argue with Susskind. You know, this is the guy who is the former president of Harvard who got himself the unpresident of Harvard by saying to the faculty that women were not smart enough nor biologically equipped enough to do science. So high IQ, he doesn't get from me for obvious reasons.
But I don't see that what you just said necessarily negates the primary contention, Charles, that the president is perceived at least as trying to stand above the fray. And a lot of these, you know, highly intellectual people that he's brought into the White House, a lot of folks who were previous Clinton administration appointees, kind of rolled him as a result.
Yeah, well, Susskind's really good at sort of the archetypical story, particularly in presidential administrations, in which he sort of broadly paints a theme. New guy in overhead, run by senior officials. If you think about it, just thematically, that's the same story that you could tell about any presidency in the first 2 years, really. There's always fighting for position around the table of the president's trusted advisors. There's always sort of knee-kicking going on under the table as people joust for position. And that sort of archetypical story that Susskind has done now, I think, in three different presidential administrations, is his sort of claim to fame in many ways journalistically. The guy does good work, I think. I mean, Ann Curry could copy edit him. But beyond that, I mean, I'm struck by the unbelievable irony of morning television fact-checking. The woman was probably cooking bruschetta 5 minutes before and will be selling, I don't know, purses 5 minutes after. But right here, we're going to get real journalistic. Beyond the obvious ironies of that, and I think we can say overall, when you tape 98% of what you do, and he does, I mean, he's a meticulous taper and transcriber, it's hard to sort of walk back from things that you've said. As I know, there was a female member of the administration who said some things about it being almost a hostile work environment, and she tried really hard to walk back from that. But you can't when it's on the record.
That's what's kind of curious to me, Lee. I mean, you'd expect the White House, any White House, is going to push back. The Bush administration pushed sure. back after his book, The Price of Loyalty, came out. Susskind's book did. Any administration will, especially when they're vulnerable, as the Obama administration is now, is going to push back. But the journalists, at least the television journalists I've seen who've sort of been interviewing him, they really don't want to cut him any slack at all. And yet he has got some pretty good resources and some pretty good techniques behind his reporting.
He does have good resources and good techniques behind his reporting. And I'm going to disagree with Charles in the sense that I actually, Ann Curry is a journalist whom I admire. And so I don't see her selling purses or making bruschetta on the Today Show. But having said that, I think he's caught in a place that those of us who write books get caught in, which is if people like your overall thesis, they'll forgive you some errors because you can't do a 100-page book without making some sorts of minor errors, let alone a 500-page one. If they really hate your thesis, they will find every nit and pick every single one of them. And I think that's the place that Susskind finds himself in. I also think that he has the journalistic curse of he doesn't have the luxury for time to actually evaluate what has gone on here.
Well, that's what I find interesting, too, because if you hear him talk about his book, obviously we haven't been able to read it yet, it sounds like a pretty balanced approach, and he seems in the end to have come down on the side of President Obama at the end, saying he has learned, he has taken more control. He did stop the old boys network within the White House. But those kinds of contentions don't sell newspapers
they don't generate
ratings.
They get lost, yeah. The overall narrative that I'm reading, and I saw him yesterday talking about the fact, and he was even bemoaning, Susskind was going, nobody's paying any attention to the fact that the last half of the book essentially says The guy's figuring it out in real time. He's very smart, and he's adjusting on the fly, as we would hope any president would do. He's incrementally learning based on incoming empirical evidence. That's hopefully what any president would do instead of just rigidly, ideologically sort of following the pattern.
I mean, this is unfair, but if you put Susskind down in the middle of the first 2 years of the Roosevelt administration, that's the Franklin Roosevelt administration, sorry, I wonder what sort of things he would have said, because there was, I mean, in a way, Obama has modeled his presidency. He keeps saying Lincoln, but I keep seeing FDR in the sense that he wants smart advisors. He wants them to disagree. And then he wants to do what Roosevelt did, which is to sort of sit above the fray and say, today I pick you and not you, and tomorrow it might be utterly different. Now, on that last part, I don't know how well he's doing. I don't get to sit around that table. I'm only a voter and a media consumer like the rest of us. But, you know, I really do have to wonder if you had that sort of insider view of the early years of FDR, how different it would be.
Well, let's look now at the second book that's up for discussion today. It's unlikely to make at least my reading list. It's by Joe McGinnis. He's the author of many good books, including The Making of the President, 1968, and a controversial one, Fatal Vision. Well, yesterday, following a barrage of media hype, his publisher released the latest, The Rogue, Searching for the Real Sarah Palin. Whereas the Today Show got tough with Susskind, they practically gave McGinnis a pass with Savannah Guthrie, at least in the edited version of her interview that we saw, rarely raising an eyebrow to the most titillating claims about the former Alaska governor.
At best, she's a hypocrite.
And at worst?
At worst, she's a vindictive hypocrite.
McGinnis says the Palin enemy list in Alaska is long, but acknowledges he talked to few friends.
Do you think you were fair to her in the book?
I think I was as fair as I could possibly have been, given the fact that she told all the people who were closest to her not to talk to me.
Now, a bit of McGinnis's book does reportedly cover Palin's days in office, but much of it really focuses on rumors about infidelity and drug use, rumors that are thinly and anonymously sourced in most instances. Now, some media critics, actually, who are not normally on Sarah Palin's side, Lee, are saying some very unflattering things about this book. Janet Maslin reviewed it in the New York Times, said it was caustic, unsubstantiated gossip, that it was indefensibly reckless. I know, again, we haven't had a chance to read the book. We can only go on what we've seen and heard so far. Does that seem like a fair criticism of this book?
Well, again, since I haven't seen and read it, and I've only seen about, but I've also read Joe McGinnis's other books, and I have to say that is particularly his the book for which he is most, I want to say, notorious as opposed to well-known. It was sourced in some ways more deeply than this book appears to have been, and yet appears to have come to some extraordinarily unsubstantiated conclusions that were also extremely hurtful to the people involved. So, you know, with that kind of track record, I think skepticism about the book is appropriate, and I guess that's the way that I would go at it. The other thing that strikes me about some of what I've read and seen is that he appears to be unable, at least from my point of view, to sort the inconsequential from the consequential. So, for example, okay, so she and her husband did sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Big deal. Even he says that's early in their, you know, that's early in their lives, and that it's not present now. So why make such a big deal of it? I mean, let's talk about the substance here.
Well, you know, at times I've heard you say, Lee, that, you know, that in some ways Palin brings it on herself because she, you know, has gotten into the celebrity, you know, role with the reality TV and all of that. But she still is somebody who's sitting out there at least flirting with the idea of running for president. So, Charles, shouldn't we be going after and sourcing better, you know, what's going to make a difference to voters if she does decide that she wants to run?
Yeah, I mean, we should be committing acts of journalism around this. What Mr. McGinnis did is anything but. It's rumor mongering, gossip, anonymous, thinly veiled attribution. I mean, you did a great job of editing those quotes, because what did he say? I was as fair as I could be to her, given that I didn't have access to her closest friends. So you conditionalize fairness toward a subject based on access to her friends. That's no journalistic standard that I know of. So McGinnis is operating in a I'm going to sell some books mode however possible, I guess. And I thought the reviews to the book actually showed a lot of attention and care to fact. And people were upset by the fact that there were no facts in this book, merely allegations.
I thought one of the more disturbing things quoted from the book itself, and again, we haven't read the book, I don't know what the context is, but one of the most notorious allegations is focusing on Glenn Rice, the former NBA star, who as a college player may or may not have had an encounter of some kind with Sarah Palin while she was a single TV sportscaster in Anchorage, Alaska. But at one point, when he is talking, McGinnis is talking to Glenn Rice about this whole thing, and he's describing, you know, oh, it was very respectful and all this. McGinnis comes back and is quoted as saying in his own book, "So you never had the feeling she felt bad about having sex with a black guy." I mean, that says something really putrid about the author, not about the person that's being written about.
Putrid is a good word, Mike.
I wonder also, Charles, whether or not, you know, the fact that it's appeared that NBC gave McGinnis such a pass. I mean, first of all, there was no hostile interview. It was a carefully packaged, like 6 or 7 minute piece. You never hear any confrontational questions. Why? Some conservatives will argue it's because the media and NBC hate Palin, but is it the fact that maybe they got an exclusive interview with him?
Well, I mean, it's because if you watch any morning television, you'll notice that 99.95% of the time, with the one exception of Ann Curry's 2 minutes of fame there earlier, everything's softballs all the time. Because any quote-unquote news presented on the Today Show or Good Morning America is merely a bumper between commercials or pseudo-commercials, whether they're on-air demonstrations or flat-out what are the 10 hottest purses today, Sam? It's selling, 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 selling. So the idea that you're going to have any hard-hitting stuff in there, I mean, I think it's why the Ann Curry clip you showed was so fantastically out of context, because that genre has no news.
But I do want to come back to something Charles said, because it is a problem that journalists face, and it is when you've got a whole side of the story that shuts down, and it doesn't have to be a political story for that to happen. It becomes very hard to commit an actual act of journalism, because there's a whole group of folks or documents or whatever it happens to be that you really can't access and make public and evaluate. You know, that's all sort of part of that process. And that's, I mean, the one thing that I respect McGinnis for saying is, yeah, this book is incompletely sourced and here's why. I don't think that's the only why. Yeah. But I give him credit for saying that.
But do you remember back in the day when we would actually not do a story because there was no access to sources? It's a radical idea.
What a crazy idea. Well, let's talk about another long-form piece of journalism that emerged this week. Not quite a book, but it's a 15,000-word, 30-page essay by historian Taylor Branch in The Atlantic. There's a link to it on our blog. I'd encourage you to one way or another find it and read the whole thing. We will not do justice to it in the next 5 minutes or so. But it's called The Shame of College Sports. It's not necessarily that Branch is making any new claims. I mean, his primary thesis that he demonstrates in a very passionate way with lots of details from talking to a lot of college athletes and doing the what historians do, going back and looking at the record, shows, at least he claims, that college athletes are being cheated, that they should be paid for their work. Everybody else is making money, that in fact the NCAA and college sports in general have been corrupted by the focus on cash, but they don't provide any cash to the players. Thus, we see a lot of the scandals with players receiving money under the table from supporters and that sort of thing. Charles, you follow this pretty closely and follow Mizzou athletics and where they are in terms of all these issues of college realignment and sports contracts and that sort of thing. What's your take on whether or not, you know, Branch made his case?
That was Mike's kind way of saying, you watch a lot of SportsCenter on ESPN when you should be reading serious stuff. True. I thought this was a really provocative, very interesting article, which raised some really significant points. That said, it also ignored some really significant points. We'll play a little yin-yang here. I mean, on the one side, I think much of what he says is very valid criticism of both the NCAA and universities that have bought in to what is essentially a system that exploits athletes for big money. On the other hand, there's virtually no recognition in Mr. Branch's work that what college athletics has done for many, many, many years now is provide opportunities for kids who had very limited opportunities, provided a college education for many kids who desperately needed a college education, provided a way out of stifling poverty, whether it's urban or rural, to a lot of kids. And we're not just talking about football players here. We're also talking about volleyball players and women golfers and everything else. So it was sort of myopically focused on football, I think, because that's where his argument is richest.
But even if we assume good intentions, and I don't know that we would all necessarily do that, but let's assume we do, his thesis is that it's gotten out of control, that there's just so much money involved now that it's corrupting the entire process. It's threatening the NCAA's basically hegemony over college sports. And Lee, you brought it to our attention. What's your take on his thesis?
Well, this is one that I actually did make it all the way through, which is startling, since I would probably more likely read a 15,000-word essay on ballet than I would on sports. But nonetheless, I think it comes at an opportune time, particularly for those of us here in Missouri, when we are talking about conference realignment, which, as much as anybody wants to say otherwise, I think really is all about money and it's all about television revenue. So his major thesis struck a chord with me. You do have to get to the end of the piece to say, okay, look, we used to do this in two venues. One was the Olympics. We got rid of the amateur designation in the Olympics, and by George, it doesn't seem to have hurt the Olympics very much at all, and certainly not the competitive nature of the Olympics. The fact that we can have extraordinarily well-paid tennis players come and play for gold medals in the Olympics doesn't seem to have diminished the level of athletic competition and expertise or whatever. Like Charles, I think he made some fabulous points. He says initially that he's going to focus on the big money sports. But I think Charles is also right. I mean, we've all had the privilege of teaching athletes at MU. In my case, it's always been women athletes who basically have gotten a great deal of help going to college and using this as a part of what informs their lives. And that's kind of what we'd like it to be, I think.
I agree with that, but I'll say his focus is deliberately on the revenue sports and those few star athletes. And probably the most quoted piece from the entire essay, and one that, you know, we ought to be a little bit disturbed about if we agree with him. He says, basically, the NCAA makes money and enables universities and corporations to make money from the unpaid labor of young athletes. Slavery analogies should be used carefully. College athletes are not slaves. Yet to survey the scene, corporations and universities enriching themselves on the backs of uncompensated young men whose status as student athletes deprives them of the right to due process is an unmistakable whiff of the plantation.
Yeah? Yeah, strong words. Maybe defensible in the abstract economic sense. And I think what Mr. Branch is going after is amateurism. And that's the part that could really be attacked, I think, pretty logically. And I think people have a hard time separating amateurism from total professional athlete, right? There's a lot of lines on that continuum. Stipends, housing money, entertainment money. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, the Oakland Raiders sitting over here off Stadium Boulevard in Columbia. You're talking about guys having money to go see a movie. And I think we are moving. The conversation seems to be moving in that direction.
Right. Lee, I'd like to get a thought or two on one more story before we wrap up this afternoon. And that involves this new report that came out yesterday from the National Weather Service about the Joplin tornado. As we all know, 162 people were killed back in May. It was a Class 5 tornado. This report makes some very interesting observations about perhaps why more people died than had to. And basically the thesis, again, in this report is that people were pretty complacent. They didn't respond immediately to the warnings that went out, including sirens going off. And then they came up with some recommendations that seemed, frankly, kind of highly technical about how the Weather Service could improve the situation. I wonder if you feel the media can learn anything from this report that will improve how they help people deal with these sorts of life-threatening incidents.
Okay, Mike, so that was your softball to me, because my answer, obviously, as somebody who researches some of this stuff is, of course we could learn a lot. And one of the things we could learn a lot is to get our hands a little bit dirty with the National Weather Service and actually try to figure out some stuff collectively that both groups could then do in times of emergency. One of the things that you put on the blog, Mike, is a study from economists, which basically says that as destructive and as horrible as the Joplin tornado was, there really weren't any excess deaths. I think that's an unnecessarily hide-bound study, but people should know that it's there. But I think the other thing is that this study, for the first time that I'm aware of in the literature, says that there is such a thing as the cry wolf effect, and that those of us who live in the Midwest, where there are lots of tornado warnings and we get extremely blasé about them, may in fact suffer from a little of this. And that doesn't just apply to the folks in Joplin. That applies here in Columbia as well.
And I'm not meaning to belittle the report, but one of the things I think the media can do is can be to interpret some of the jargon that comes out of this. Here's a recommendation. Mm-hmm. To improve severe weather warning response and mitigate user complacency, the National Weather Service should explore evolving the warning system to better support effective decision-making. This evolution should utilize a simple, impact-based tier information structure that promotes warning credibility and empowers individuals to quickly make appropriate decisions in the face of adverse conditions. Huh? We could do a better job of interpreting for the public the practical implications of all of that. Well, one last thing before we go. We got a comment on our blog last week from someone who identified themselves as Alan, and Alan wrote this. I want to point out up front that I am not a fan of Bachman. In fact, I am a progressive Democrat who will be voting for Obama in 2012. But I thought you were too quick to dismiss the concerns that have been expressed about Merck's Gardasil. Mightn't you have been equally dismissive a decade ago if someone was the canary in the coal mine warning about Vioxx, Merck's previous blockbuster product? Seems that Merck needed a new revenue stream and for pennies on the dollar. Got Perry to order one up at taxpayer expenses, even though Perry was notoriously stingy otherwise when it came to funding Medicaid. I'm honestly disappointed that all of you would be so unwilling to question the agenda of a big pharma corporation who already has killed thousands of people in a quest for profit above principle and prudence. Okay, Lee, I'm going to start with you because I think this was kind of aimed at something you said, but we all talked about it.
It's Lee's fault.
Were we not sufficiently critical of big pharma in taking on what Michelle Bachman said about Gardasil?
Okay, first, Alan, thanks for writing in. We appreciate it a lot, and I hope more people will do that. Secondly, as I remember it, the focus of our conversation was Michelle Bachman repeating unsubstantiated claims and making those claims applicable to a whole class of people, namely young women who are in line for cervical cancer. I don't think anybody here is necessarily in love with Big Pharma. I do think there are lots of instances where you can look at what Big Pharma has done in terms of fudging data in order to get drugs on the market, and probably even more instances when very careful research indicates that although there are risks for taking many, many drugs, most of us are a whole lot better for having them in the stream. The discussion about whether or not we spend too much money on pharmaceuticals for certain reasons, I think is a very appropriate one, but not one that I thought was appropriate last week. So if you want to have that one, go to some of the discussions on the Henrietta Lacks book, where this is also a sub-theme of what the author wrote.
30 seconds, Charles?
Yeah, I mean, I think one can certainly question the motives of Big Pharma and direct-to-consumer advertising of pharmaceuticals and still, I think, get to a comfort point with the fact that the scientific consensus still seems to coalesce around the need for an HPV vaccine.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. And again, I also would like to thank the commenter for writing in. We hope more of you will do that because we certainly occasionally might step over the line here or there. And even when we don't think we have, we enjoy talking about that with you. But, well, here we go again. We're out of time. We have always lots more to say, but we're not going to say it today. Thanks to Lee and Charles for sharing their thoughts. And thanks to you for listening and writing. You can visit our blog to read, hear, and watch comments and content related to our show, or you can leave a comment, as Alan did. You can also write us at views@kbia.org. Our technical crew kept us together for another week, thanks to Director Travis McMillan with RJI, audio engineer Pat Akers with KBIA, and our new student producer, Ryan Williams. I'm Mike McKean. Please join us again next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.